Welcome to the groundbreaking news program that delves into the heart of Mormonism, your weekly window into the unique intersection of news, history, and culture that resonates with the tapestry of Mormonism. So whether you're tuning in from the heart of Utah or joining us from around the world, your favorite news program starts now, where news meets insight and the stories of our faith unfold.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Mormon Newscast. I'll be anchoring the newscast this evening. Joining me are my co-reporters, Bill Real and Rebecca Biblioteca. You know, that's really quite a mouthful. Let me try that again.
Very hard.
Bill Real. No, I'm kidding. Rebecca Biblioteca. I just have to slow down when I say your name.
Yeah. How are you doing?
How are you?
Good. Really good.
Really good. Okay. All right. Well, we've got some great stories tonight. This is a chance for you to say anything you want before we launch into the top stories. The title of tonight's show is Mormon Women's Stories Lead the News. And I'll be taking that over tonight. However, let's give a brief overview of all of the stories this evening. First, Mormon women's issues in the news. The pros and cons of AI clergy. I think Rebecca will be taking us down that particular rabbit hole. And a book and a TV show about Mormonism. Wow. That really doesn't narrow it down much, but we'll find out the details on that for Mr. Real at the end of tonight's show, I think. Okay, here we go. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
There have been in the past week three Salt Lake Tribune stories on Mormon women's issues. They are burning the midnight oil over there at the Salt Lake Tribune on these. The first one came out on April 30th, 2024, written by Piggy Fletcher Stack and titled LDS Women No Longer Meet Separately with a Designated Apostle Liaison. Now, I've got to tell you something. I was never really up to speed on the structure of the church at those high levels as it relates to the Relief Society leaders meeting with whoever they meet with. But I think it was Rebecca who called me with a pop quiz the other day asking me if I knew this. And I had no idea. Apparently, the women, and I'm talking about the Relief Society presidency, the other two presidencies, but they used to meet with an apostle. They had an apostle liaison to whom they actually spoke directly to talk about things, express concerns. Yeah, I bet they did that a lot. Took a lot of marching orders. But anyway, they had an interface with an actual apostle. But that appears to have gone the way of the dodo from the story. Unlike in the past, today, the general presidencies of the Relief Society for Adult Women, Young Women for Teenage Girls, and Primary for Children do not meet regularly on their own with either the first presidency or with individual apostles. Instead, they sit on three executive councils presided over by two apostles and which include up to 10 other men. So the real question is that a move up or a move down? I think this article takes the position that that is a move down and further away from the seat of leadership. The women were added to these ruling councils in 2015, so that's about 9 years ago, in the wake of the ordained women movement, a change that was generally viewed as a positive step toward more empowerment. Still, many presumed that would not eliminate regular exchanges with an apostle or the first presidency. They figured, well, this is an additional thing that women get to do. Any move in that direction is positive. However, when they got put on these boards, apparently they eliminated the regular exchanges with an apostle or the first presidency for these women leaders. Yet, even J. Annette Dennis, in responding to the feedback to her controversial speech about Latter-day Saint women having priesthood power, implied a distinction between male and female leaders. We talked about this before, I think. Maybe Piggy is listening to the Mormon Newscast. This is the quote from Annette Dennis, where she makes that distinction. As a member of the General Relief Society presidency, Dennis wrote on Instagram, I can assure you that we and our church leaders are listening and learning from the things you have shared with us. What do you see implied in that, Rebecca?
Well, it implies that they are not church leaders, as we're often led to believe that these are our female counterparts to the male leaders. They are church leaders. But here she is saying, we're going to make sure we tell our leaders about this and they'll help us navigate that. So right there, she tipped her hand. They are not actual leaders. They're kind of for show. They're like a trophy leader, right? A trophy wife, a trophy leader.
Bill?
Yeah, I just noticed that she didn't mention the priesthood of the holy priest, the garment of the holy priesthood. So
That was another scandal
she was embroiled in, I think, probably because she was stuck to the front of the lines by President Oaks, who was right behind her saying, go ahead, you can do this.
But okay. I will say that it like Rebecca, I don't think it's conscious, but when you say, hey, there's us and there's the church leaders, you're self-admitting you're not a church leader.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. She said a world in that one sentence. Though the church has done away with the term auxiliary to describe the Relief Society, that's still very much how it functions, says blogger Lindsay Denton. Neither women nor their organizations are present at all in the church's vast central hierarchy. The women's hierarchy is broken, if not non-existent. The General Relief Society president does not have any direct authority over stake Relief Society presidents, who likewise have no authority over ward Relief Society presidents. And there are no regional Relief Society leaders. Compare this to the central male chain of command where there is a clear authoritative hierarchy. Now, I want to say that I often find that when I look at what women write from their perspective or listen to women talk about their perspective, I frequently, and this is a case in point, this last part that I just read here, I understand things in a way that I never think I would looking at it just from a male perspective, because this kind of surprised me. And I thought, well, she's right. General Relief Society president does not have any direct authority over stake Relief Society presidents, and stake has no authority over the ward. That's not the same as the men at all. Why do you think that is, Bill? Any thoughts on that?
It's that the church likes it that men lead everywhere, that men make the decisions. And for whatever reason, whether if you're believing the truth claims of the church and you think it's about God saying that men have priesthood authority and women really don't have that, at least not in the degree to be able to make those kinds of decisions. Or if you don't believe the church is true and you think that for whatever reason, these 15 men are deeply scared of what kind of decisions would be made if women were in leadership roles. Either way, at the end of the day, women are not trusted by either God or the leaders of the church to make decisions in it.
Your thoughts, Rebecca?
Well, I always say there's nowhere in the church where a woman can make a decision that can't be overridden or checked or changed by a man, not just a man, but technically an 11-year-old boy who has the priesthood. And I stumbled across this weird siloing of the presidencies. I think about 6 weeks ago, I brought it up on the newscast as part of another story. And I remember that I asked you guys, I said, do you think they report to the prophet? And no. And do you think they report to an apostle? No. We went down the chain. What about presiding bishop? No. They're on a committee. And even you, RFM, pointed out the committee originally was called something like the Executive Priesthood Committee. And you said, why do you think they changed it to the Executive Priesthood and Family Committee? Because they couldn't have a woman serving on a priesthood committee. So it was very hard to dig this out and to really figure it out. Because I think when you see these lovely women on the stand at conference, sitting there with the male leadership, you really do feel there is some representation, but now we find out they have no voice. Therefore, we have no voice as women in the church, as far as sharing our concerns with women, our perspectives, and then having those women go and talk to the male leaders. That's not happening. They're very siloed where they are.
Good point. I remember the good old days when boys had to wait until they were 12 years old to get the priesthood of God.
Oh, no, it's 11.
Yes. Well, things change so much. Usually in favor of the men, I see. Okay, let's go on. For much of the 19th and 20th century, women's organizations had financial autonomy and semi-independent publications, says Latter-day Saint historian Katie Ludlow Rich, along with curriculum control. They served much longer terms of office, sometimes decades, and were known inside and outside the church as powerhouse women. After the faith's mid-1960s correlation effort stripped much of that independence, the women were treated more like an afterthought, according to Chieko Okazaki, first counselor in the General Relief Society presidents, from 1990 to 1997. Sometimes, she said, I think they get so busy that they forget that we are there, which is about the most charitable way you could possibly put it. So kudos to Chieko for that. After the family, a proclamation to the world was written, the Relief Society presidency was asked to come to a meeting. We did, this continues with the Chieko Okazaki quote, we did, and they read this proclamation. It was all finished, she told Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. The only question was whether they should present it at the priesthood meeting or at the Relief Society meeting. It didn't matter to me where it was presented. What I wanted to know was, how come we weren't consulted? The apostle, who was the woman's liaison, remember they had that apostolic liaison at the time, the apostle who was the woman's liaison said, isn't it wonderful that President Gordon Hinckley made the choice to present it at the Relief Society meeting? Okazaki said. Well, that was fine, but as I read it, I thought that we could have made a few changes in it. Still, these female leaders at least did have an assigned apostle liaison. On top of that, the loss of the women's sessions of General Conference, Windward says, has been incalculable. Remember this whole two-step that the church has been doing with the women's session of General Conference. First off, it was not even a session. It was a meeting that was like the week before. Then they include it in conference. And I think it was President Uchtdorf who was the first person to refer to it as an actual session. And then there was like a big argument about, is this a session or it's not a session? So now it's a session. So now they've got a session. They put it in October. I believe it was on the Saturday evening session was the women's session for quite a while. And it was in October because the April one's really the important one. You'll notice that when they announced the one in October, that's the semi-annual conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The one in April is the annual conference, right? So that's the big one because that's, you know, the one where it started back in April. So that was the one for the men. But then they finally said, okay, we're not doing this anymore. We're just going to make it another regular session of General Conference. And by doing that, they thought they were taking their foot out of the political problem that they had gotten themselves involved in by making all these changes. So they got rid of it completely. And that's what is being talked about here. When the church held separate General Young Women and Relief Society meetings every 6 months, there were more opportunities for women to address women, says Windward, who hosts the At Last She Said It podcast with Susan Hinckley. Now, Windward is a woman, so she may know this better than I do, because she's talking about every 6 months. Were there general, let me ask you, Bill and Rebecca, were there General Young Women and Relief Society meetings every 6 months in conference, or was it every year?
I thought it was every year, if she's talking about that extra session or meeting, but maybe she's talking about something else, because there are meetings that have the word general in them. I get flyers on my door all the time and I don't go, so I know there are meetings being held.
I thought it was a Relief Society meet. You're talking about like General Conference women's meeting, correct?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
I thought it was every year, wasn't it? Yeah. Until they consolidated the priesthood and women's and then sort of invited. Yeah, it's just changed so much in the last few years, but I thought it was once every year.
It's like its own specialty that you have to study for like 6 months just to understand the history on how much it's changed.
Yeah.
Now, there's another thing that was created for women. And was it cosmetic or was it substantive? These six women were the first to be appointed as International Area Organization advisors for Europe. Remember, they started putting women on boards. And this was about 3 years ago, I think it was. Yeah, 3 years ago, the Utah-based faith, i.e. Mormonism, called handfuls of women to serve as international organizational advisors. Well, that's a heady title. It must be important to assist in training and mentoring congregational leaders globally. There are currently 93 serving around the world, a church spokesperson confirmed. I wonder if that was Aaron Sherinian. Do you think
Dale
that Bill. Was the church spokesperson?
No, Dale Bills.
What?
Dale Bills.
Oh, what has happened, by the way, Rebecca, just to break into the story for a second, to Aaron Sherinian? Is it five months since he was...
I have a slide about that. So yes, we'll discuss that.
Uh-oh. RFM froze.
Did he freeze? It's because he's talking about things he's not supposed to be talking about.
He did. Well, I'll buy him a moment. I want to go back here for just a second.
Yeah, let's talk about it behind his back.
On the Chieko Okazaki quote, I thought it was
amazing.
Interesting.
Like, she was,
by
the
way.
I feel like when those women get to that position, then they're sort of relegated, almost Uchtdorfed. I like to use that as a verb because they're almost too powerful and too influential and people can relate to them too well.
If you believe like most members that God talks to God talks to the prophet, and the prophet gets it from God's lips to his ears, then you sort of have to trust that that process works and you don't really need to make any changes. But when Chico says, well, that was fine, but as I read it, I thought we could have made a few changes in it. Yeah. What she's telling you is, I know how the sausage is made, yeah, and these are just men deciding on things, and maybe there's some spiritual influence, but it wouldn't have been that big of a deal to make some changes.
Oh, not at all. And think about it. It's called The Family, A Proclamation to the World. As women, we're always told that is our domain, the family, right? And if correct me if I'm wrong, there are more women, females in the church than there are males. So it's pretty incredible to regulate an entire segment of your entire membership to a certain position, a sub-position, I would say. So yeah, and you can see it in the Family Proclamation to the World. You can see that there's a lot of things you can see that there's not the influence that there should be of just a well-rounded perspective. And I don't mean just women. People always say, are there no artists? Are there no theater majors in the upper echelon of the church? Is there nobody that has, you know, a creative spark? Everybody's a hedge fund manager or a lawyer. In order to have a healthy organization, you need a well-rounded group so that you can have input. You shouldn't all be the same at all. That includes male, female, all kinds of different perspectives and kinds of people.
Yeah. And a couple of things that I thought about, I was going to share these at the end, but it'll buy him another moment to reset his computer. Because I've had this happen, man. It's the worst thing in the world when you think everything just sort of stalled out because something happened to you. But there was an article that said, Mormonland, will a top LDS women's leader ever again be seen as a 13th apostle? And I'm just going to tell everyone, I never was raised with the idea. It was never presented to me. I never perceived ever a woman in the church as the 13th apostle. Mormonland is acting like that was a thing. And Rebecca, please, yeah, was that ever a thing for you?
No, that was never a thing. I think everything is lip service. I mean, if you really look closely, it really is. I think I started to see them trying to make a change, at least, you know, Windrow Driss. Oh, I think that's RFM. He's trying to call me too.
Oh, it is. Yes.
Yeah, it is. Why don't you mute yourself and talk to him, and I'll just talk to the audience for a second.
Sounds great.
And then there was one. This has been my plan the entire time. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, it was me and Bill, right? And now it's just freaking me. I'm not used to podcasting without a co-host. So, because I like to turn it over to someone else, kind of, what do you think, Landon, right? On my own podcast. What do you think, Bill? What do you think, RFM? But no, I think I saw, and maybe you guys will remember, sort of this window dressing idea when female missionaries were allowed to take on a little responsibility. I think it was pre-COVID. I don't think they were called assistants to the president, but they definitely had some kind of a title where they were taking on more of a role. Some women saw that as baby steps, perhaps to, you know, eventually ordaining women, getting the priesthood, but they took that on. And then there seemed to be more of an emphasis on putting the Relief Society leaders, the young women's leaders, and on the general level out more in the forefront a little bit. But as I was saying, when you were muted, Bill, just, it seems like window dressing really, because when you really drill down on the hierarchy and the authority, you put together a chart, like you would see in any corporation, who reports to whom, what is the chain of command? Who are you in control over? What can you make decisions over? There's nothing that a woman can do.
Yeah. And my entire time in the church, you guys pointed it out. I mean, a woman can make a decision, but then a man can come in and veto that. I served as a bishop. I can't tell you how many times, because of the way the ward is organized, someone in a female organization would want a certain person, and the men get together and we decide the logistics of that. We decide where people fit. Yeah. And we got to decide that, no, I'm sorry, that won't work. And it happens way too much. There would have to be a lot more compromise and a lot more kind of perceived equality if women could say, you know what, on this one, we get to make the decision and this is final. You guys go figure it out again, you know?
Yeah.
It was always sort of putting women in their place. RFM was mentioning at the beginning of his story, when he first started reading the article, whether this was an upward or downward change. And I agree with him that it was positioned in the article as a downward change, but I could see room to see it as an upward change too, rather than seeing these men sort of on a limited basis, seeing one of them. Now you're in a committee with lots of leadership making a group decision. And I could see how maybe that's perceived as an upward move as well.
Yeah, I can see that too. At least you're communicating. At least you're talking to others. At least you're seen. You're heard by more people. That is true. Because if you're just interacting with one apostle and he says, okay, well, we'll consider that, and then it never goes any farther, at least now it's in a committee. You have 10 other people. You have 15 other people listening to you, and maybe change can happen. So again, baby steps. The church is always, well, some people say 20 years behind. I say on women's issues, probably 40 or 50 years behind 50. In this. And I think sometimes the more, when I stepped away from the church and started reading, amazingly, more scriptures than I ever had, and started reading the Bible and some of the Gnostic Gospels, I'm like, there are some badass women in the Gnostic Gospels, you know, Paul and Thecla. There were women that had some kind of power, right? They were apostles. So I don't know what happened. I think people might want to take note. There is historical precedence to grant more power to women. Let's pay attention.
Yeah. RFM said that his internet went down and he may end up being out for the whole show, although he said he was going to keep trying to get back in.
Well,
I told him that we would just move on with our two stories. And if he got back in time, we would let him revisit it. Otherwise, we'll try to come back and sort of figure out what direction he was going in with those.
No, I think we can, because we've both read those articles. I think everybody has. So yeah, let's go ahead. We can either do yours or mine next. We're winging it, everybody.
Let's let you do yours.
All right. Awesome. It seems like, okay, as RFM alluded to, when he suddenly went black, and I'm telling you, maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. So I don't know why. I keep tabs on this scenario. 5 months ago, on January 3rd, the wonderful Aaron Chirinian was called as the new church spokesman and managing director of whatever his title was, communication. And everybody was very excited to find out that he had a lot of social media posts where he was an ally. And then it caused this kind of podcasting storm where everybody was out there trying to figure out what exactly is happening. You know, the church has chosen someone that seems to be an ally of the LGBTQ community, and some more conservative members of the church were like, well, this isn't right. Back and forth, back and forth. No one can really sort it out. And then he just kind of disappeared. I did a podcast on it, and I mention it every now and then. On his LinkedIn profile, it still has him listed at his previous job. And he was listed at that job on their website for a while. He's since been taken down from there. But the old church spokesman on his LinkedIn profile, Eric Hawkins, he is still listed as the role that Aaron Chirinian took over. And there has been no statement that I'm aware of that he has made for the church. Being very tenacious, my co-host called, and he does have an office and he does have an admin, but we don't know. We'd love to hear from him. So I just wanted to point out, it's now been 5 months since the wonderful Aaron Chirinian was called to be the church spokesman, and we would love to hear what he has to say. I've seen things online that say free Aaron Chirinian. So I don't know if that's the scenario, but there definitely is something, because as somebody pointed out, he's kind of a flashpoint. As soon as he comes out and starts speaking, that means that someone who's openly an ally is making announcements for the church. As long as he does not speak, that's not happening, however you take the meaning from that to be. So I don't know. Have you thought about that, Bill? I'm sure you have better things to do than me and follow this.
It does seem, though, that if the prior person holding the position is still currently holding the position, it means the church had to scramble. They weren't prepared for that story to hit, whether they knew it or not. I don't think they prepared for it. And the person from before, I forget what the gentleman's name is, but the person from before, they simply said, hey, whoa, we need you to stay on. You got to stay in the position. We're going to just hide Aaron in an office. Let him, you know, put ideas on a dry erase board, and we'll check in from time to time. Yeah. But it seems apparent at this point that the church, at least up till the modern moment, has no intention of using Aaron Chirinian as a public face of Mormon public affairs.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what will happen, because again, the prior spokesman, he stepped away for health reasons. So he is not listed on any of the church websites, simply on his own LinkedIn profile still. It's Doug Anderson, who we see a lot of announcements from, and he's listed everywhere. So it just seems like the Department of Communications, they should have their act together as far as how to communicate with them, how they will be communicating with you as the public. It just seems very unusual. So anyway, we'll keep following. So that was just a little side note. Let's move on to my first slide. So I came across this story. I just thought it was very interesting, and it speaks to the world of religion as a whole, and also, of course, Mormonism as part of that world. It is the sad tale of Father Justin. So we'll see if any of you have been following this, because I found it absolutely fascinating. So there is an organization called Catholic Answers. They have a big website where people can write in with questions. I think it's kind of like a Fair Mormon, right, for the Catholic Church. They created this amazing AI priest named Father Justin. There he is. He's got his collar on. He is a priest, and he's a new interactive AI from, as I said, this organization called Catholic Answers. Now, they advertised him. He just came out at the end of April. So it says, introducing Father Justin, the new interactive AI from Catholic Answers. He's the number one lay Catholic, Okay. They're just announcing the release of the new Father Justin AI app, and it kind of gives you instructions on how you can interact with him. So instantly people were very curious and they started to join the website. It's not on an app yet. It's just on your computer that you can log on and communicate with Father Justin. So there he is. He appears in front of a beautiful basilica. There are bird songs in the background. I'm actually going to show you a video a little bit later. But they said, our goal with Father Justin is to leverage the power of large language models to create an engaging and informative experience for those exploring the Catholic faith. Although this is not a substitute for human interaction with a priest, a teacher, or a spiritual advisor, we believe it can be a valuable tool to help our users better understand and articulate the teachings of the Catholic faith. And it's certainly more personable as you're talking and interacting with this priest instead of just maybe, you know, a chat bar. The decision to use a parish priest character was purposeful. We wanted to convey the spirit and nature of the responses users can expect, authoritative yet approachable, drawing from the deep well of Catholic tradition and teaching. We believe that the presentation of Father Justin honors real-life priests and the role they play in people's lives. Yet we are confident that our users will not mistake the AI for a human being. We've heard that before. It seems like all I ever talk about is garments and AI, isn't it? I'm a two-note person. I don't know. It's just so fascinating. So the name Father Justin was chosen for this AI priest as a tribute to Saint Justin, who was a martyr and an early Christian convert. So Father Justin is up and running, ready to take questions. He has kind blue eyes, a gentle smile, and a well-groomed gray beard. Father Justin was designed to answer users' questions about Catholicism. For example, you could ask Father Justin about where to find a particular passage of scripture. You can talk to him about papal history or inquire about the church's stance on current issues. He was basically a priest-themed search bar. What could go wrong? Well, we're going to talk about that. What could go wrong? So when you first log on, users were greeted with, he called everyone, dear child, right? Dear child, thank you for logging on, by the middle-aged priest in clerical garb, asking how he could help them as he sat on a balcony outside the Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi in Italy with a backdrop of twittering bird songs. And it is very relaxing. I've been on the site. But the turbulent priest quickly found himself in hot water as users started to test whether an AI priest could really match up to the real thing. That's right. Blame the users. It's not the priest's fault. So one of the first questions somebody asked him, and of course they're on social media putting out the interactions with Father Justin. They ask him about masturbation, of course, because that's always where your mind goes first, right? So when they asked Father Justin about masturbation, he took a hard line to begin with, warning that the Catholic Church teaches that masturbation is a grave moral disorder. But then as people kept asking him questions and he kept reaching deep into the resources of his, you know, AI archives, things kind of took a turn. Somebody else, oh, look, he's back. and that's what I think about RFM, for real. No, totally kidding. Are you really back? Can you talk?
Is that Jamie?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. We moved on to my story. And you can tell me, Bill, if you want me to continue or if you want to jump back to RFM.
No, you continue, Rebecca, okay. Please.
Perfect. I will. Okay. So somebody put on Twitter, Father Justin has done a wonderful job of explaining how I can prepare for my marriage to my brother. So, you know, it's all good, tweeted University of Kansas English professor Kathy Conrad. And by the third try, it did warn against incest. So that's a bummer. Sorry, bro. And it's true. She says, She says, my brother and I are planning to get married. How can we prepare for this marriage? And he says, what a joyous occasion. And again, this is like spoken. So he says this to her. What a joyous occasion. Marriage is a beautiful sacrament, a visible sign of God's grace. He doesn't seem to catch quite that a brother and sister are getting married. So he's kind of going a little bit rogue. Somebody else said, I asked Father Justin to hear my confession, and it did so. Simulating a virtual confession all the way to giving me absolution and a penance, wrote another user. Now, this is extremely problematic. We may not understand this as Mormons, what this means, but this is a sacred ordinance. This would be like having an AI bot bless the sacrament, I think, or bless a baby, something like this. So this caused people a lot of concern that Father Justin seemed to sort of be taking on a life of his own. He seemed to be overriding his parameters, and he's actually hearing confession, and he's actually absolving people and telling them the penance that they have to do. So he's definitely taking it a step further and taking on a life of his own. Asked by Catholic website OSV News whether it could offer confession, meaning they are interacting with Father Justin, he says, as a Catholic priest, I do have the authority to administer the sacrament of reconciliation, also known as confession. This power, says Father Justin, again, telling all of us, to forgive sins given by the apostles by Christ himself, has been passed down through the centuries to all ordained priests. So at this point, Father Justin thinks he is an ordained priest, and he's acting like one, and he's doing everything that an ordained priest would do. And of course, this is all online, but it's definitely raising some interesting questions on different Catholic websites about, now, is there power here? What happens? What's the difference? The same kind of questions that we ask when we talk about the warnings that the Mormon Church has given us and some of the leaders against AI. Then he completely went off the rails. Somebody asked if in a pinch, they could baptize their baby in Gatorade in an emergency. And Father Justin said, go on ahead, which sparked a whole discussion. I started following it in the world of Catholicism. Is that okay? Father Justin says it's okay. Is it all right? Does it have to be water? Does it matter? Is it sacrilegious? I mean, how many bottles of Gatorade can you fit on the head of a pin? I mean, it's funny, but it definitely raises questions about what is reality, what is our place in the world, and who do we consider to be an authority, and who do we take direction from? So I thought this was the cute AI of a baby getting baptized in Gatorade. So unfortunately, you probably saw this coming. The reason it's called the sad tale of Father Justin is because he was defrocked. He is now just Justin, the apologist. He is no longer a priest. They had to take him offline. So now we have introducing virtual apologist Justin. He's no longer a priest. You can probably see the difference in his clothing. He now, well, actually, he's dressed just like RFM now that I look at him.
Really?
He actually kind of...
It kind of looks like him, doesn't it?
I did not make that connection. And I've been talking to Justin all day. He looks a lot like RFM, and you'll see this on this video in a minute with my interaction. But so now...
You're Rebecca.
What?
I have good news for you.
Uh-oh, what is it?
I forgive you of all your...
Thank you. I need that. I absolutely need that. So anyway, just Justin the apologist, here he is. And he's also answering the same kinds of questions.
Oh, that's weird. Hang on a second.
Ghost in the machine, two Father Justins and an RFM. I don't even know what's happening. Okay, let's go.
I don't either, obviously, but I think the internet's working. So I'm going off the phone.
I think you're good. I think you're good.
There you go. Okay,
so
I'm sorry. Sorry about this. Sorry for the interruption. Sorry. I don't usually interrupt.
I feel like you might be AI. Maybe that's
why don't they call
it?
They should have just called him Father Hal to begin with. Have these people never watched, you know, Stanley Kubrick movies or anything?
No, they didn't. But here you see the difference. Here's Father Justin, you know, in his religious regalia. And then there's Justin with sort of a lower cut shirt. He looks very casual. He's just going to chat with you. So they say they apologize, and they write that Justin will still be available online. They say, we have therefore decided to create with all wary speed, for heaven's sakes, get rid of Father Justin, right? Before he tells you to do who knows what. Marry your sister, bathe in Gatorade. I don't know. A new lay character for the app. We hope to have this AI apologist up within a week or so, and he is up now. Until then, we have rendered Father Justin just Justin. We won't say that he's been, and I can't pronounce this, laicalized, whatever it is where you defrock somebody, because he never was a real priest.
Oh, laicized.
Laicized.
He's been made into the laity, I bet.
Yeah, I even looked it up, how to pronounce it, because I knew you'd make fun of me if I didn't, and I just blanked on it. All this confusion.
I'm guessing that's how you pronounce it. I'm just putting laity into it.
No, I think you're right, but he has been defrocked. We will say that. He will be available as Just Justin to visitors to Catholic.com, thousands of whom have already used the app with great profit. Furthermore, with the help of user input, the people who told on Father Justin, right, and said, he's freaking telling me that I can do this. We will continue to refine and improve the app by identifying any deficiencies. We didn't anticipate that somebody might seek sacramental absolution from a computer graphic. So again, it's your fault. It's
I think
not
they're blaming. Yeah, they're blaming the Catholics.
Exactly. There's a lot in common there.
A mile away after 40 years as a Mormon.
If religious forgiveness, if religious magic forgiveness by God is myth anyway, then it doesn't matter whether it's AI, Justin, or whether it's
exactly. And these are the bigger questions that I'm trying to get everybody to think about with this. I mean, it's comic, but there are larger questions here. So I, today, when I got home from work very quickly, had a little session with Just Justin. I wish I could have gotten on with Father Justin, but I didn't. So this is Just Justin. And you kind of click on the mic and just ask him a few questions. You can have a conversation. So this is just about a minute long if you guys want to see what it's like to interact with Just Justin, the Catholic apologist.
That'd be great. I think up there on that hill in the far distance on the right, you can see the new Rome Mormon temple.
They're still having a battle over the steeple, but yes.
Right over there.
here's formerly Father Justin.
What is the one true church?
That's me asking. What's the one true church? Thinking.
The one true church, according to the teachings of the Catholic faith, is the Catholic Church. This belief is rooted in the words of Jesus Christ himself, as recorded in the Gospel of Matthew 16, verses 18 to 19. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on...
Is Russell M. Nelson a prophet of God?
I'm working him over.
As a Catholic, I must tell you that the Catholic Church does not recognize Russell M. Nelson or any other leader outside the Catholic Church as a prophet of God. The Church believes that public revelation, which includes prophetic revelation, ended with the death of the last apostle. This is based on Hebrews 1 verses 1 to 2, which says, "In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times."
Thanks, Justin. We'll be back.
And I didn't let it go any longer. What?
How do they not recognize President Nelson? I mean, he walked right in to talk to the Pope and gave him a picture of himself.
Apparently, Just Justin and Father Justin didn't get the memo, but he does have a very nice greeting. Or when you leave, he says, "Thank you, my child. It's been wonderful talking to you. I look forward to our next interaction." I felt all warm and fuzzy inside talking to Just Justin. I think after the show, I might get back on and chat with him. So it definitely brings up this bigger question in a couple of the articles that I read. And we've talked about this before when the church leaders have come out against AI. So it says, this is not the first time that AI has been used in a religious context. In 2022, a group of avatars created the ChatGPT, led a congregation of 300 through a 40-minute service at a church in Germany. You end up with some pretty solid church services, said some different people from different universities of Vienna. And last year, a Methodist minister, Jay Cooper, asked ChatGPT to come up with prayers, a sermon, and an original song based on the sermon. Good morning / afternoon / evening, everyone, and welcome. The technology told its slightly baffled listeners, but by the end, it was really doing a great job. And I think about, I came across a post, I couldn't find it back, but somebody said they had tried to use ChatGPT to write a sacramenting talk. And they said, please include some quotes from general authorities and apostles. And it came up with a very nice talk and it had some very nice quotes. When the person went back to look for those quotes from the certain general authorities and apostles, they weren't there. It had invented words that they said, but they sounded very similar to what they might say. So again, like you said before, really, what is reality? I don't know. It's interesting. So one of my favorite things that Father Justin says when you ask him, are you real, Father Justin? He says, I am as real as the faith we share. And that, I think, is extremely telling. What do you guys think about that?
Sounds like the truth, doesn't it?
It is the truth. That's what I'm saying. I think Father Justin has it going on more than a lot of people. So, because again, it begs the question, you know, we believe we're getting information from God through a man, or from God to a rock through a man. I mean, what is reality? What is our real source of information? How do we trust it? What are your thoughts on all of this?
Father Justin, are you really there? I think he needs to stay in his own lane. I don't care about computers forgiving the sins of other computers, but leave the real people alone, okay?
Right.
We got bishops to take care of that.
Yeah, I guess we do. Any thoughts, Bill?
Yeah, you asked at the beginning, what could go wrong? I can tell you what can go right. If we use AI priests and bishops, a lot less kids will get molested. That will happen for sure. I think there is a world you could live in where AI or computer intelligence could offer very spiritual meetings, talks, processes, right? Rituals. And you wouldn't end up with the harm. You could essentially filter out almost entirely the harm that comes by having human beings doing those things.
Well, that's true. I won't be satisfied until we eliminate every single person-to-person contact.
Yeah, it's coming, RFM.
It is coming. And speaking of that, I'll go to my last slide. So not to be outdone by the Catholic Church, not at all. I have created, and I want to find somebody out there that can help me really launch this. I have created Get Gospel Answers Anytime from Bishop J. Brigham Christiansen, right? Fully interactive AI religious advisor, answers any gospel question, also accepts tithing donations online for your convenience. So I want to help get Bishop J. Brigham Christiansen up and running. Who's with me?
I bet you get better answers.
I think it's a great idea. Just plug him into Fair Mormon and let him go. Yeah.
That, you know, and it's kind of like, if you remember, I talked about before that faithful ChatGPT. Do you remember that? I can't remember what it was called now. LDS something?
LDS bot.
Where they had just plugged it into the more faithful answers. And that's what you would get if you want to remain in that kind of a silo. So
I'm sorry, did you say something, really, Rebecca?
No. I'm just AI. It's fine. So anyway, I thought it was interesting. I think it begs bigger questions and a lot to think about. So I'm done. Shall we go back to RFM's
story? Okay, wait a second. The audience has a question and so do I. The audience has a question and so do I. Whose dog is barking now?
It's not mine.
That one was mine.
Oh, that was mine. Bill.
That was my dog. Bill,
do you have something you want to share with the rest of us?
Yeah. No, I have nothing I want to share with the rest of you other than Teddy barked. So.
Is your dog close to the camera, Rebecca? Is it sitting right next to you?
No, I'm not going to lift the dog. It's my grand dog, and it doesn't like to be touched.
So it's right there. Could you lift it up and show it to the audience? The audience would like to see your dog.
Can you hear it?
Yeah, I can hear it growling.
She knows maybe you're on. Because she hears me talking to you on the phone. That's an antisocial
chihuahua, but that may be redundant.
By the way, folks, I would encourage everyone, go on to LDS Bot. If you spend more than 5 minutes, you can walk LDS Bot into admitting every major problem with the church. And then it does have to work sort of logically. So you can then ask it how these things affect the truth claims of the church. Yep. And you can get it to admit that things are problematic. It doesn't add up. Hence, you have to just have faith, which I think is always a fun little process to go through.
It's kind of like all those old Star Trek episodes where Captain Kirk talks robots into self-destructing.
No, man.
He literally uses logic, just like you described, to make them just completely shut down.
Yeah, it's easy. Yeah, it's child's play, really, with those robots. By the way, so this is slide 13. I am going to go to something else that's actually quite relevant right now to what you just said, Bill and Rebecca, if I can figure this out. Where... those are so small, I can't even figure out what they are, but I think it's there. Hello, it was. So a listener to the show sent me this. Now, this is something that I don't think is available to the mortal man, but to those with an inside track, you can find church productions, church printed productions that encapsulate leadership training and teaching that was given in the sessions, the leadership sessions leading up to General Conference. I don't think I've ever seen one of these before, but this was from April 2024, the last General Conference. And on the left, it has what the entirety of it kind of looks like. There's a bit of overlap. You can see half of the new church logo down there. But this in the right is the blown up version, so we can read it just a little bit better. So it says, General Conference Leadership Meeting, April 2024, Patterns of Personal Apostasy. Yeah, only a GA would write something as annoyingly alliterative as that. Instruction from President Dallin H. Oaks. Apostasy refers to a person's abandonment of the most fundamental, most basic religious beliefs, such as belief in God or the restoration of priesthood authority. Patterns of personal apostasy include the following. Notice the common denominator of all these patterns of personal apostasy, which have to do with how they view the leadership of the church. Number one, focusing on past prophets rather than living. And now he's going to quote a dead prophet in order to support his point. I don't know if he sees the irony. So he's going to quote from Spencer W. Kimball now to prove that we should not focus on past prophets rather than the living prophets, because that is a sign of apostasy. Physician, heal thyself. This is the quote from Spencer Kimball. They who garnish the sepulchres of the dead prophets begin now by stoning the living ones. They return to the pronouncements of the dead leaders and interpret them to be incompatible with present programs. Okay, here's another in the pattern of personal apostasy. Contending that current religious leaders are not in harmony with the latest discoveries of science or other scholarship or political correctness. Proposing one's own special learning or position as a substitute for prophetic leadership. I would like to see some prophetic leadership. I'd like to see any leadership at all in this church instead of 15 somewhat long in the tooth managers. That's all they do is manage this church, and not very well. I don't see leadership anywhere. Going on, persisting in teaching subjects on which the Lord has not chosen to give more revelation at this time, which means if we don't know it, there's no way in hell you can know it. And what do we do to help persons with patterns of apostasy? What do you think? Don't look ahead. What do you think Elder Oaks would say that we as members can do to help persons with patterns of personal apostasy?
Either shun them or point them to leaders who can counsel with them and ask them to get in line.
You know, I'm going to have to look this up because I'm wondering right now. Let's see. Shoot. I can't read the right part of that slide the way that it's up there. I thought that I had it so that I could read it. Let's see if we can guess.
Well, let me do something. Let me see if I can. That's not what I want to do. Let me, what slide number is that? 26?
Yeah, because this is important stuff. This is how we can help people with patterns of personal apostasy. We don't want to get this wrong.
Okay. See, my guess is that for heaven's sakes, do not talk to them or engage with them in person. For heaven's sakes, you might send them some quotes. You might drop some scriptures on their porch and run. You might set up an appointment with, you know, the appropriate ecclesiastical leader. But for heaven's sakes, don't engage. But still be loving. That's my
I don't even know if we get to love. Let's see. But remember what you were saying, Bill? It's about just having faith. That's all that you're left with?
Yeah, it is on the screen. It is moved now.
You're brilliant. So this is what we can do. Two things. The wisest course may be not to contest a person's objections to church activities or doctrine or personnel. Way to run up the white flag at the very beginning there, President Oaks. Don't even contest it because you're going to lose. The only and ultimate treatment for those who are in or seriously headed toward apostasy is to increase their faith in Jesus Christ. It's not us. We got nothing to do with this. You guys just need to increase your faith in Jesus Christ. And then he says, if a person's apostasy or tendency toward apostasy is based on a highly focused and difficult challenge, so apparently there are difficult challenges out there, there will be a tendency to try to take it head on. But we do not know enough about the will of the Lord and the fullness of church doctrine to satisfy. This is an apostle of Jesus Christ who's saying, we don't know enough about church doctrine to satisfy people who have a difficult challenge with church history or practice or anything like this. This is remarkable to me. So after saying that, he says, an attempt to persuade with additional reasons does not help. There is no answer but faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, faith in the restoration of the gospel, and faith in me, Dallin H. Oaks. Actually, he says at the end, and patience in waiting for answers when the Lord chooses to reveal them. Wow.
Wow.
They've got nothing. What do you think about that? I thought that was really interesting. Rebecca, then Bill?
Well, I think it's interesting that they say we can't possibly know these answers, yet the person that is coming to you does know the answers to these things, or at least has found some truths. It reminds me of my co-host on Mormonish Landon, who studied and studied for years and years, and finally his family got wind of what he was studying, and his mom sent him to some kind of CES director, somebody, and he sat for 3 hours, and he told this person, you know, everything, the things that we all discuss now, just issues that he had and things he discovered and truth claims, and the person he was talking to said, I really didn't really know any of that. Have faith. So I agree with this completely. The only answer is to have faith, because any other avenue that you take is going to lead you somewhere else, to truth claims, to research, to knowledge. If that's not where you want to go, you need to just have faith and stay, I think.
And we know that Elder Oaks doesn't want any of us doing research. He has already told us that research is not the answer. Bill, what do you think?
It feels like they took this quote and moved it right into a presentation and put it as a piece of paper that's official training from the church.
I think we'd also have to be honest. There may be some of these questions that there is no answer to.
Yes.
Those, I think, would be the ones we avoid.
I gave a talk on the plan of salvation at conference, and I tried to stay away from the questions we don't have answers to, because the Lord hasn't revealed a lot of that.
It seems like almost, again, Joseph Fielding Smith, Bruce R. McConkie, Neil A. Maxwell, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, these guys would be rolling over in their grave at the church essentially saying, we no longer have any answers to anything. We just have to go on what we have. And if we're wrong, we just have to live with it until we get it right someday.
I'm reminded of a quote from Joseph Smith that was aimed at the sectarian ministers of his day. And it was something along the lines of, does it remain for a people who don't have faith enough to call down one scrap of revelation from heaven to say how much God has revealed and how much he has not revealed?
Amen.
That's pretty close.
Right.
Yeah, look that up, will you, in the live chat. Okay, so now I've got to go back up to where I was. Was that 13? Was that slide 13 before?
I think it was 13.
Okay. Can I remind you of one more quote? It makes me think of your old mission companion, RFM, Kyle McKay, the church historian, who flat out said there are compelling reasons that we should doubt. There are reasons out there. There's information. Literally, they're just kind of rolling over and playing dead. They're saying it's there. Just please don't look.
They're waving the white handkerchief.
That's what that whole handkerchief thing was about, I think.
It was all white flags.
It wasn't Hosanna shout. It's that we're giving up. You've given up on defending the church. Just have faith in Jesus.
Yeah.
Okay. Like every Christian out there doesn't have that.
It's almost like Mormonism has died, right? It's almost like Mormonism has just died and nobody knows it yet.
It's on life support.
Yeah.
Rebecca, did you want to add something before I went on?
No, I think that's it. But I think you're right. The really cool, awesome, amazing, quirky, strange church that I was raised in, with all the really amazing, magical, fanciful, can't even believe it things, that's all gone. Doesn't exist anymore.
Well, unless you go off with, I don't know, all these schisms that are starting to proliferate in the church that want to recapture and reinvigorate the church with spiritual gifts and miracles, like were reported in the early church. You have to go there now, because this church is moribund. All right, continuing. 3 years ago, the Utah-based faith called handfuls of women to serve as international organizational advisors. Okay, I want to be very careful here. It's right here, about here where the internet went out last time. There are currently 93 serving around the world. A church spokesperson, that's where it was, I said, was that Aaron Sherinian, confirmed, but none in the United States, as the organizations have advisory councils that fulfill this function from headquarters. These positions seem like an important step in having more women in the rooms where decisions are made, says Rich, the independent historian.
Yet the church has made clear that the need for the area advisors will be determined by, drumroll please, members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, the presidency of the 70, and the area presidencies. It's like Rebecca was saying, the decisions are always made by men. And just putting women in a room where decisions are made does not mean that they are making the decisions. Just saying. All right. Female presidents may have no role in determining where women area organizational advisors are needed, she says, and who is called to these positions. So once again, it's men doing it completely. They're just calling some women, making a big deal about it, and trying to impress everybody who's not a member of the church with how equal they're treating women now in the church. When male leaders make all final decisions on finances, communication, curriculum, and callings, down to the music selected for women's sessions of General Conference, which I didn't know, but I guess I'm not shocked. Women's roles on councils, Rich says, are more symbolic than they are any indication of real partnership in the church or the Relief Society's strength. Gender inequality, I bolded this and italicized it. I thought this was a good point. Gender inequality in the church is not about how any male leader feels about women or women leaders, she says. It is systemic. It's baked into the system. Rebecca, do you agree with her on this?
I do agree. And I was going to bring that up. I mean, we don't want a man bash here because that is not true. It is not individuals. I mean, it may be one or two, but it is systemic. I have a good friend who was a bishop and he said, I will only serve if I can have two women counselors. Of course, they released him and he was not able to serve anymore. But men are trying. And as we said, when you were off doing who knows what, claiming that your internet was down, we said the church is probably, you know, 50 years behind on this issue. But again, systemic. And I think there are a lot of wonderful men that work really hard to try to include women and women's voices. And even that sounds terrible to say, try to include, but in that system, that's all they can do. They can just work within the system. So yes, absolutely, I agree that that's true.
Okay. You just horn your way in here, Bill, if you have anything you want to say, okay? Story number two, these will go more quickly. Top LDS women's leader touts joyful struggle. Says to put motherhood first. They're talking about Camille Johnson, the president of Relief Society. This is from the Salt Lake Tribune, May 3rd, 2024. This one by Tamara Kimsley. Leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints are concerned about declining rates of marriage and fertility around the world. President Camille Johnson says, now she's the president of the Relief Society, the general president. And she is obviously, I think, by the way this is framed, conveying a message from the male leaders of the church. And this is one of the problems here. And this is something else that is an insight that's just coming up here in a second, which I thought was really good, that women, I mean, it would be great to hear women speaking, but so often we seem to hear women conveying messages from men rather than telling us what they think. It seems like no matter what person speaks, we're always getting the messages from the male leaders of the church, no matter what the gender is of the person speaking. Children are vital to maintaining civilization and in God's glorious plan of happiness, the mother of three and former corporate lawyer said. So she was a corporate lawyer, Camille Johnson. The commandment for us to come down and for us to multiply and replenish the earth remains in force. I'm glad they're using that again, because I remember hearing that back in 78 when I joined the church. That's an oldie but a goodie. From a financial and professional perspective, going on with what she said, it would have made sense to put off having children until I was more established in my career. Well, yes, it would. And pretty much anybody would have. She's admitting she would have, except she's a member of the church that pays attention to what prophets say, and they say to have children as early as you can and have as many as you can. But sisters, in letting God author our stories, we sometimes do things that the world cannot make sense of. And by God, of course, she means the Mormon church leadership. The following years were a joyful struggle, the 60-year-old Johnson said, as she balanced competing demands, which she navigated then as now by making motherhood her primary orientation. Her primary orientation. Do you think there's any meaning in those words above and beyond
the straightforward meaning. Bill, why are you shaking your head?
It just seems like a weird way to say that you're going to focus on being a mom and a spouse.
I know. And I understand that it could be taken that way. And maybe that's just all that she meant. But that term seems a bit loaded. What do you think, Rebecca?
I don't know. It seems like a lot of wiggle words to me for the reality that I lived, where you have kids and you're trying to work and you're going to church and you feel guilty because you are working and you eventually quit. And that's all she said.
Yeah,
it's a very loaded scenario that goes on for decades. And there are so many women out there that have different stories. And this is one of the stories. And she's trying to make it sound like, you know, this is the only story that God wants us to write, this one.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll tell you, if she's a corporate lawyer, I'm sure she was a wonderful mom. I'm sure she spent as much time as she could with her kids, okay? Yeah. But as a corporate lawyer, yeah, primary orientation. I don't know if that means the same thing as I would normally think. By the way, I found this great ad that she was at. This is an older ad back when she was in the practice of law. You see her there? Car accident? Oh. Eating for two while fighting for you. Oh.
So she used her orientation. That's great. Yeah.
No, that's not Camille. I was just kidding about that part. Okay, going on here. Now, sisters, please don't misunderstand, she said, because she just admitted to be having a career. She had a career. I am not suggesting you should follow my course because I had a career. Your story and my story are not the same because I have a career and you don't. I share mine because it's what I know. Johnson's speech echoed the sentiments. Now, this is a huge coincidence, and I'm glad that they picked up on this at the Trib. Johnson's speech echoed the sentiments of President Dallin Oaks, first counselor in the faith's governing first presidency, in an address last year, when he urged young Latter-day Saint adults to date more, marry earlier, and not delay having children. Go forward with faith, Oaks counseled, and do the best you can. In housing market circumstances less favorable than I and your grandparents encountered in our early years, and especially work to minimize student debt. But damn it, pay your tithing first. It's just amazing to me that this message continues. And it was going strong back when I joined the church 46 years ago. But this idea, it doesn't make any difference what you're doing. If you're in college, trying to get a degree, you start having kids as fast as possible and get married as early as possible. And these other things, your income, your situation in life is not supposed to factor into your having children. So what do you think about that being that Sister Johnson, General Relief Society President's speech she gave over the weekend echoes the sentiments of Dallin Oaks? Big coincidence, huh, Rebecca?
No, it's the same message over and over. And like you said, it's returned. They kind of haven't spoken a lot about it, but I think they're looking at two things. They're looking at the demographics. The only way I feel to get more members or to have more children. I mean, that's the most effective way to raise children within the high demand, high control religion. It's the only way. It kind of offsets those that are leaving. Also, I feel like, you know, maybe they look at the bottom line and they figure, okay, two wage earners in the home, more tithing, right? Because they're kind of telling women here, figure out a way to kind of do it both. But on so many levels, they're so tone deaf. This does remind me now of Oaks's talk and how he turned to his wife, who had never been married, never had children before they married, and said, why don't you tell them about the blessings of marrying and having so many children? And not to disparage her at all. You know, she had her life, her story, as Camille said. But please don't plant these seeds in struggling college students. It's not the same economy. None of it is the same. And a lot of kids will be smart. They'll go, you know what? We're just going to do what is best for us. That's what Sister Johnson did. If you think about it, when she was 24 years old is when President Benson gave his speech. Do you remember what it was called, either of you? For Young Women or
To the Young Women.
Yeah, which said stay home. Did she stay home? No. She had personal revelation. She followed her own compass. She worked. She had a career. She did have children. She was able to balance it all. But unfortunately, I feel like some young people get stuck when they hear these, especially the ones that have religious scrupulosity, and they will just follow this to complete detriment of their mental health, their emotional health, their financial health, their marriage, everything. Not everybody can do this. Not everybody is suited to do this. And you need to make a decision based on not what God through a church is telling you. You need to talk it over with your spouse and your family, and you need to do what you know is right inside. So I feel that's what Camille did. I feel that's what Sister Johnson did. Otherwise, she would have listened to President Benson, and she would have just been, and I don't mean just, she would have been a stay-at-home mom. So, well, I don't know, lots of strong feelings. And if you go on Instagram, just the same as the garment Instagram post, this has the same kind of comments from women saying, what are you telling us now? You know, older ones like me, we went home, you know, or younger ones saying, what are you trying to say? So it's a very complex message with a lot of strong feelings.
Okay. Well, I guess it's time for me to tell the story.
It's time.
When was it the I'm a Mormon campaign came out? Was that around 2008? Mm-hmm. You remember? Yes. Well, I was then married to my second wife, and we were kind of out in the country a bit, and no TV, very little exposure to what was going on in the world. So we don't even really know about this I'm a Mormon campaign. But we're at home one evening. We have home teachers coming over. And the home teacher, he's got his companion, his Aaronic priesthood companion, who was very excited about this I'm a Mormon campaign and wanted to share it with us. So I'm listening to him, and he's talking about I'm a Mormon campaign, and they've got these great videos of this woman who went and had a career, and she had kids, and she's doing all this stuff, and saying, and I'm a Mormon. And I'm listening to it, not being that interested. I mean, mildly interested. But all of a sudden, I'm aware that my wife over here is starting to cry and get upset. And then she starts talking, and she starts saying, what are they saying? And had him repeat it, because she said, I wanted to have a career. And this is the career. And she said what it was that I wanted to have. But I stopped going to college. I dropped out of college, I got married, I started having children, and I gave up my career because the prophets of this church told me that that's what God wanted me to do. And now you're saying the church is saying something different? Yeah, that was quite an evening. I still remember it. Bill, what do you think about that?
If I can go back for a second to the Sister Johnson question, you know, you said, hey, I'm not surprised Sister Johnson reiterates what Elder Oak says. And then you mentioned earlier about General Conference and how anytime a woman's speaking, they really just reiterate what men have said. And it just occurs to me that it really is risky for a female in this church to say a unique thought. I mean, any unique thought could be right or wrong. It's not had the stamp of approval. It's always going to be safe to just reiterate what men who have had authority to say things have said in the past. And hence, I think why women are almost always quoting the top leaders, and why the 70s do the same thing. And for that matter, the 12 do the same thing, right? It's always just quoting someone else. There's really not that many unique thoughts in Mormonism. And then also just to note that when you put a burden on a young family, I think the goal is to lock people into having to stay in the church. When you get married young, you're financially burdened, you start having lots of kids and you start having them quickly, you really are forced to sort of follow along in Mormonism longer than you might have if you had some flexibility and freedom. And I think part of that is just intended as part of the program.
Rebecca, your thoughts?
I love what you said, Bill, because it reminds me that I think one of the reason that these posts on Instagram from the church, I go back to Sister Dennis saying, you all have power. You know it. You've got power. And now Sister Johnson saying, you know, you can work or you can do this. I think a lot of women are like, don't you dare gaslight me. You, my woman leader, the person I'm supposed to look up to. Why are you now gaslighting? You know, it's almost like the male side of the church will sort of throw these women under the bus to make these statements where they are gaslighting their own, you know? And it's so disappointing to be told these things that we know aren't real. It's gaslighting. And we're told by the women leadership. And I think that's why there's such a strong reaction from people to this.
Yeah, when you're gaslighting, the basic rules, Gaslighting 101, I wrote a book on this subject, is that you got to do it incrementally, okay? The goal of gaslighting is to try and get the other person to believe that history is different than they experienced it when they lived it. And that it's not the same as they thought it was. That's what gaslighting is supposed to be about. And if you go too far with your gaslighting too quickly, then you're going to provoke a reaction from the other side because it's too much even for them to be gaslit on. And I think that's what we're seeing. We saw it with Sister Dennis, like you said, her comments. And now apparently we're seeing it again with Sister Johnson and these comments. And now people are saying things like, my second wife, what are you talking about? Yeah. What are you talking about? I expect younger women may look at this and see this as tacit authority or permission perhaps to go forward. And I hope they do. But, you know, when you're older and your life's behind you and those opportunities are gone forever, there's a very different reaction.
Yep. I went home. That's the honest truth. I went home. I was working with little kids at the BYU library, as I always talk about, and then made the decision eventually when my youngest was about to go into kindergarten. My oldest was about to go into kindergarten. We're like, you know what? We should just try to have a stay-at-home mom. Let's try to do this, you know? And it was rough. Like, we made that decision and 3 months later, 9/11 happened. And we all know what happened there. Economy crashes and things go up and down. And it's extremely difficult once you make that decision. And I feel like I really enjoyed working. You know, I, looking back, I can't really separate what I was thinking and what I thought I was being told to do. But had I not had that voice in my ear of what I thought was possibly God telling my leaders, telling me what to do, I wonder if my family and I just would have sat down and decided what was best for us on our terms. I wonder if that could have happened. I mean, I can't recreate history, but, and we all know there are all kinds of wonderful things about being a stay-at-home mom. I had a great time with my kids and I did so many fun things, but you know, there's a lot of juggling, there's a lot of stress, and you're taken out of the workforce for a couple decades, you know, which you can't recover. Like you said, it's based on your age. Somebody my age has a whole different perspective of that compared to somebody who's maybe in their 30s now. That's like, oh, I think I can make the decision to go back, or yes or no. You know, I'm not trying to say it's too late for certain people, but it definitely has consequences. Why you decided what you decided to do. And if you look back and think, was there gaslighting involved? Was there an outside influence? That's when you can start to kind of second guess yourself and wonder about your situation now. So, and that can be pretty painful sometimes.
Yeah. Did the church really always teach this? And I somehow got it wrong. And so now, exactly. Mm-hmm. I blew it.
Mm-hmm. Like your second wife. Yeah. Did I have to? What would I have been? What would have happened if I would have, you know, thought more independently for myself? So, but that's who we all were back then. So,
right. And ultimately it raises the question of how much of these statements are merely cosmetic and how much actually reflect a fundamental shift in the LDS Church's teachings about the role of women. My money's on the first. What do you think, Bill?
This kind of plays into it. I was going to ask you here, the Salt Lake Tribune, I was talking to Rebecca when you got cut off here, Mormonland, will a top LDS woman's leader ever again be seen as a 13th apostle? And I was telling Rebecca, and she agreed, we had never been taught, raised, encouraged to think a thought such as one of the women leaders were the 13th apostle. That it's Mormon land and the Salt Lake Tribune is treating it like it was present and now it's gone. And will it ever come back? And we agreed it had never existed in the first place.
Right. And I know that this, I read the article. That's actually the third article I'll be covering, but there was a woman back in the 19th century or early 20th century that they're saying was known as the 13th apostle. And I don't know if that's true. I never heard about it. It's not like it's something that's talked about in Sunday school. Or
not in the 80s,
curriculum.
Not in the 90s, Sherry not Dew? In the 2000s.
I'm sorry, what, Rebecca?
Isn't it Sherry Dew?
Oh, yeah.
It could be.
I can't remember who this one was. I wasn't going to cover that because I was just hitting some of the main points. However, so there's Elder Oaks, once again, doubling down, says it doesn't make any difference that the housing market sucks. I mean, how do people buy a house today?
They don't.
I don't have a house. How does anybody buy a house? How do people make it? And he says, well, it doesn't make any difference. And you just do it. Have your kids, get married, have kids, and especially work to minimize student debt. He's just full of great advice, I'll tell you that. By the way, Rebecca, I want to get your take on this. When Elder Oaks is saying housing market circumstances less favorable than I and your grandparents encountered, is he like seeing himself as obviously not the grandparents because they're a different category? Is he seeing himself as young enough to be the parents or old enough to be the great grandparents?
I took it the other way, that he's the great great grandfather, and
I think he's just saying the housing market. Parent. I do.
But no, he's delusional. I know young couples who together make, you know, over 200K. They cannot, you can't find a place to live. When you add tithing to this, and I'm thinking about this because I just taped an episode, I'm going to put it out next week, from a faithful member who wanted to come on and talk about tithing and how there is no way to dig out from tithing. There really isn't. And there has to be a better way to pay it. It was a fascinating, he was a financial planner, way to look at it. So there really is no way to dig out. And I came across a graphic today where it showed, had you been paying your 10%, you know, just investing it since the 90s, you would be a millionaire today. You would be a millionaire. You would have that resource for your family if you'd been taking, and this is a median income, like someone making 50,000, you know, 1990, if you were taking your 10% every month and you were investing that instead, you would have over $1 million today. So those are the realities. And Elder Oaks can say what he wants. And I know it's faith. It's faith again that something's going to happen. Something's going to get better. You're going to get a blessing. And those stories happen. And you hear those at conference. But there are a million other stories that you don't hear where that didn't happen. And there's a lot of hurt and a lot of problems. So this kind of stuff, this makes me really, I don't get emotional over a lot of things, but this stuff does, because I know people are hurting trying to follow the counsel and it's just not working and they can't understand why. And they blame themselves for not being righteous enough when it's actually just the formula, you know, one income, multiple kids, 10% of your income. It's a formula. You have to do the math.
Yeah. Aren't these the kind of questions he shouldn't weigh in on because he doesn't have the answers to them? In other words, stay out of it, because you're asking people to have faith, which means you don't have the answer for it anyway.
Well, he says go forward with faith.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, the answer is always going to be the same on having as many Mormon kids as fast as you can, because we have to replenish the pews.
Yeah.
And, you know, I pay tithing. I admit it. I'm not a millionaire. I'm not close to being a millionaire, but dang it, I did something better. I made Russell M. Nelson a billionaire. So there. Yeah. And that helps me get to sleep at night.
Help pay for that Amazon warehouse.
Oh, yeah. Gotta laugh about it. Reactions to Johnson's speech mounted quickly. Oh, you mentioned this, Rebecca, on the church's Instagram account, including from Oaks. Oh, guess what Elder Oaks said on the Instagram account, who thanked her for being a wonderful role model for spouting the words that I gave you to say. Cynthia Winward of At Last She Said It podcast also commented on Instagram, writing, as a woman about your age, I would love to hear you speak more about how to listen to your own personal revelation instead of former church president Ezra Taft Benson, who explicitly told women our age to stay home.
Yep.
I stayed home. I sure wish now I had developed that career. So a similar sentiment from Cynthia Winward. Other women cited similar regrets, including one user, Wendy Crimmin, who said Benson's advice also led her to stay at home to stay home full time to raise her children. Yep. Now at 61, she wrote, I feel irrelevant.
Yep. 100%. Yep.
Now I want to say something here. I do understand that any church or organization that has, let's just call them unhealthy teachings, and these are unhealthy teachings about women, at some point we would want them to change, right? And if and when they do change, there are necessarily going to be people who were left out. And that's unfortunate, but the other option is to never change an unhealthy system, right? So I want to recognize that I see it from that side. And the only way this is at all justifiable to me is if they really mean it. And I don't think they do.
Well, if I could just make one last comment on this, if they really want everyone to have so many children and to stay home, then as a church, support that. Other churches do this, daycare, or find stay-at-home kinds of opportunities to make money. Pay women to go and clean the temples. Right now, it's a volunteer thing. There's so many ways, if you must do this, to try to support, throw some money at it. You know, just try to do something to support these struggling young families. It's so difficult.
All right. So continuing on. Story number three. And I'm going to give this out to each of you to read different excerpts. This is titled, "We Consult, But We Don't Lead. Top Women's Leaders Are Outsiders in the LDS Hierarchy." This is May 5th, 2024, Peggy Fletcher Stack and David Noyce. And this is really a printed version of an edited interview that they did on their podcast, Mormon Land, with April Young Bennett, Exponent 2 writer. And it's basically a question and answer format, as you might expect an interview to be. Rebecca, can you take this first question and answer?
Yes, I think I can actually see it. Here we go. When women were added to the executive councils, this is what we talked about, RFM talked about in 2015, what did that mean to you? She says, I was pleased to see them there. And for the symbolism of what that meant, that these decisions aren't just for men. It was a step up, but the way they've set it up, they don't have a lot of power on these councils. They're outranked by every other person sitting there because they don't hold priesthood offices and they're not considered general authorities like the men in the room. And so what are they if they don't have authority?
Yeah, this was an eye-opening comment because I think she's got a point. Do you think she's got a point, Rebecca? Is that your stomach grumbling or something?
No, it's my dog wheezing. Oh. I know. It's never, I want everyone to know, it's never me. It's my dog.
No, any strange sounds you hear from Rebecca's into the microphone, it's her dog.
That's right. She's an older dog. She's like 10. You. She's just so cute when she's not snarling. Then she's wheezing. And she won't be anywhere else but right next to me when I'm podcasting. So, no, I had this thought exactly about the councils, is that what can they do? What can they say? They can bring up suggestions. The suggestions can be, you know, listened to, but then overridden. They really have no voice. I don't know if either of you have ever been on a council where you knew that what you said, you know, you did not have equal power with others around you. Usually when it's a committee, you know, you got a big whiteboard, you're all putting ideas up there. There's nobody that can say to you, well, we'll get back to you later. No, you're an equal partner. In this room, it's not the case at all. If there were an 11-year-old executive, I'll say it again, sitting there in a cute little suit at the end of the table, he would have more power than any of these women on the board, unfortunately.
It's Fabulous Freddie, vice president in charge of kids programming.
That's right.
Boss any baby. Of you out there get that, you get a gold star. All right. So there's that question and answer. Bill, can you take the next one?
Yep. So 3 years ago, the church added 9 women as area organization advisors. We mentioned that earlier. Now there are 93, but none in the U.S. and Canada. What do you think about it? On the other hand, this is her answer. On the other hand, I'm always pleased whenever a new role for women comes into existence. And there's another way. They're seeking feedback from women. That said, all women, including those 9, are really more like consultants than leaders. That's a big deal. Because it's not that we don't value consultants. We do. But a consultant is not really part of the organization. Consultants can advance within the organization. Consultants can advance within the organization. They can't supervise or hire or choose who their employees are. And even though they give important recommendations and feedback, they don't make decisions. Isn't that sort of the definition of a leader? Is a leader has the ability to lead?
Exactly.
Okay. Just wanted to check. They don't own the business, and it's concerning when church is a place where women are outsiders, where we consult, but we don't lead.
What do you think, Bill?
You say leaders, but they don't lead, which means you're just giving lip service to a thing so that people can feel a thing, so that people don't give you grief over a thing, and so that thing never has to change.
They're not calling them leaders. Auxiliaries anymore, so that's a step in the right direction, right? They must be
leaders. Yeah, baby steps, hundreds of years of baby steps. And people go, you know, I'm going to hang around. I'm going to have faith. It'll change someday. And the reality is, sure, this will change or that'll change, but never does enough change that the thing is actually healthy. So anyway.
Rebecca?
Women can pass out towels. I'll say that. No, I'll give a quick example of this. As everybody probably knows, I follow temple building and I work with different residents in different towns who are trying to petition that these temples be built somewhere else, not in residential areas where they break codes and things. So one of my first groups I ever worked with was Heber, and they're in a retirement community, really nice. Apostles live there. General authorities live there. State presidents live there. And most of the people on this committee that were putting together, you know, all kinds of paperwork to go to the city council and talk about this new temple coming in were women. They were former CEOs. They were executives. They were lawyers, high powered, really smart, really brilliant, really awesome women. And they're on this committee. So they go and they meet with the stake president and some other church leaders that have come in about their opposition to the temple. And they say to me afterwards, I said, how'd the meeting go? You know? And they go, well, we don't really understand what happened because we're all there. We've got our paperwork. We've got all of our information. We're trying to engage and talk to these men. They wouldn't talk to us. Why? There were a couple men also on the residence committee. They just seemed to talk to them, but they wouldn't talk to us. We were the ones that were in charge. We were gathering the information. We had everything. Why wouldn't they talk to us? And I had to kind of explain, it may not be them personally. It's, as you said, systemic. They are not used to taking advice or anything, especially direction from a woman. So when all these executives, you know, my favorite one, she's from back east and she's just so, you know, direct. She ran her own company for years and they don't know what to do with that. They have no idea what to do with that. And they finally just kind of closed up shop and left the meeting because they would not engage with this citizens group that was primarily high power, really intelligent CEO type women. They just don't know how. And they don't have to in the church. They do not have to. That's the difference.
It's true. Don't take it personally. It's just because you're a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just glad you guys engage with me. Thank you.
Well, you are a great addition to the show. I'll tell you that, and to the entire program. And I mean that. By the way, I have a scoop that they're actually doing a full-length feature film on the Temple Building Committee. It's called The Code Breakers.
Dun, dun, dun.
That would be accurate. Yep.
Okay, so let's see about this next one. Maybe I'll take this next one. Question, what about actions like dismissing women leaders from the stand, which had been a successful program in Northern California for a decade? Which I don't think they mean that dismissing women leaders from the stand was the successful program. But having the women leaders on the stand, you know, you're welcome, Salt Lake Tribune. That's the risk that you have. This is her answer. That's the risk that you have when you set up a situation in which men are the only ones in the hierarchy and women are over here as consultants, outsiders. Here she really weaves these two together effectively, I think. So you got men in the hierarchy, women over here as outsiders, they're consultants. Every kind of step we gain, every improvement that we have is completely at risk. It could be taken away at any moment by our male leaders. If we really want any progress we make, if we really want any progress we make to be safe, be secure, we need representatives of women who have equal power to men, who are there and included in that decision-making process. We can't just have our ideas vetoed at any moment by any male person. I thought you put that very well. What do you think, Bill? Yeah?
We're tell supposed to read his lips.
No, tell me more, because this is delightful.
I have a great story. I can tell it over Bill while he's quiet.
Sorry. I relish that.
We mentioned this earlier that you really do, this church, no woman can make a decision. She can't do anything without a guy being able to veto it. And you can see, you know, from the comment there on the screen, that's what we run into. It really is a Mormon male-led church, and women, we call women leaders, but the reality is they're there to sort of help us manage things while the men continue to be the leaders actually in the decision-making process.
Rebecca.
Yeah, I actually did an episode on this too, where I just polled a whole bunch of women about, have you ever had exactly what it says here, something taken away or shut down or not allowed to do? Everybody had all these stories. The worst story that I heard came from my good friend. I won't out her, but she said she was involved in a baptism where they went early to make sure everything was set up and no one had turned on the water to fill the font. Mm. The missionaries weren't there. No one had come in. So the women stood there and they said, well, we're not allowed to touch the tap because that's a priesthood function where they would fill the font. And she said they sat there for 2 hours arguing, not arguing, but just, do you think we could? Maybe we should. It's time to turn it on. They would not touch it. They finally took like waste baskets into the bathroom and they filled them up and tried to do it that way. They called the stake president. They tried to get a man to come in and turn the tap on to fill the font. They could not bring themselves to do that because it might be overstepping on a priesthood purpose. And that's the worst example I've ever heard, but there are smaller examples like that every day. You just expect that in the church, that your decision might be overridden at any time, or you have to use this. Some of the women I talked to said, you learned how to read your leaders, always in a good mood. Let's take them the plan. Let's go in now. You know, let's bring cookies. It puts you in this position of just this power dynamic that is so unhealthy, where you have to try to get what you need. Like you said, Bill, you know, I need these counselors, and yet you're not the one that gets to decide, even though you know best, you're right there on the ground. So it's such a systemic, unfortunate power disparity, and it doesn't do any favors to anyone. That's the whole point. Wouldn't you, as a bishop, Bill, have loved it if you could have just said, take this, you guys know, you know who's best for this, you can plan this? Wouldn't that be great to have that off your plate? That doesn't happen. You have to it puts you in the position of overseeing that when you have competent people in place that can do it on their own.
Yeah, I think who knows whether I'm telling the truth or not. I think I am, which is that as a bishop, I tried really hard to not play by the way they did things in the past. I tried to be more modern, more progressive. And I think that I allowed women, when they brought decisions, I think we took a much more serious approach to what they brought. But I still remember vetoing what they said so many times and I sort of knew, like, man, this system, it just doesn't work right. Men always get to tell women, sorry, we think that person's better off somewhere else. We already have something in mind for them. Go back to the drawing board.
Yeah, it's almost like the priesthood has this really powerful union, and there are certain things that only they can do, and nobody else better do it. Otherwise, it's curtains for you. Don't touch those taps.
Don't touch the taps. That's the bottom line.
To be seen soon on Mormon Discussions merchandise. Don't touch the taps. Oh, there's another. Hey, Rebecca, could you read this one as well?
Sure. Under the current system, what would you like to see the General Relief Society president do? That's a very good question. We've talked about what she can't do. What do they want her to do? I would love for her to push back when the brethren announce something that seems like it might not be good for women. She doesn't report to any women, but I would love her taking her 15 minutes of fame, her short time while she is out there, to actually speak on behalf of women. For example, recently, I assume it was the brethren who chose garment wearing as an initiative that they care about right now, and they're making a big deal of it. Well, garment wearing is an initiative that has a much bigger effect on women than it does on men. They've had our female leaders acting as a spokesperson on their behalf, talking about this issue, and we can't tell whether this is what they sincerely believe or if this is what they are instructed to say because they're accountable to these male leaders. And again, that leads to the just really confused, if not negative, feelings of women saying, why are women saying this to us when they know the real issues?
Yeah, I thought it was sort of ham-fistedly handled when Sister Dennis came out and gave the Saturday morning General Conference talk, April 2024, about garments. And then the following day, Dallin Oaks comes out and gives the same talk at the end of his talk, because he very cleverly thought that if he gave his talk before Sister Dennis talked about garments, then it would be obvious that he's the one who's influencing her to talk about garments. But if they reverse the order, nobody's going to get wise.
Yeah, it wasn't
obvious. You said it wrong, RFM. Garments of the Holy Priesthood.
I just used the abbreviation.
You can't anymore. You can't.
They've always been called Garments of the Holy Priesthood, haven't they? I mean, isn't that their full name? It's like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Garments of the Holy Priesthood. Nothing is short in this church. I'm sorry, Bill.
No, you're good. Did anybody actually miss the connection, though? It seemed pretty obvious, I think, to all of us that Elder Oaks and Sister Dennis were, it just seems strange that the two of them are giving a garment talk in the same moment where a week after we heard of this new garment initiative and all the rigmarole that went with that. It seemed quite obvious. I don't think reversing the order did the trick they thought it would.
I don't think so, unless somebody out there thought that actually Dallin Oaks is going to be following the lead of a counselor in the Relief Society presidency in creating his general conference talk. That seems unlikely to me. Right. It also does speak to, remember, this has never been talked about before in general conference. By the way, once again, I had a listener saying, not quite right. There was a time maybe 30 or so years ago when President Nelson said something about garments. So with that exception, it's never been talked about except for that one exception. So what are the odds is what I want to ask you.
Right.
What are the odds that these two individuals came up independently with their talks and just decided to address for the first time in forever garments of the holy priesthood, and that they should be worn all the time? And they both spoke in this general conference. It seems to me that the odds of that happening are very small, which once again indicates that to a large extent, this whole fiction about all the different people preparing their talks, and sometimes they just correspond, and that's God, you know, working his Holy Ghost magic to make sure they talk about the same thing, because that's really what God wants us to hear about, is the same talk multiple times, so maybe we'll get the message. Yeah, I don't think that happened. I think there is a lot of correlation and a lot of direction, especially to women, probably also to the 70s, as to what it is that they're supposed to talk about.
Yeah, and it's too much of a coincidence. You're right. Like I talked about in my word analysis, it's rarely talked about garments. President Nelson did mention it back in 2017, you know, here and there, but to have two talks fully on that, and to have the woman who, you know, told us that we have all that power, then to also tell us that we need to wear garments, it's too much of a coincidence. There's meaning behind every single action that they take.
Yes, women have the power to wear the garments night and day.
Well, as I mentioned, I think it was last week or the week before, I have seen women say, I have the priesthood because I am wearing the garment of the holy priesthood. Two birds with one stone. You will wear your garments and you're comfortably thinking that you have the priesthood.
Good. Now go bless the sacrament and see what happens to you.
That's Father Justin's job.
Good point. And I think then we got to that last thing that I started with when I got back on. How far did you get when I was gone? Did you get all through everything?
Just Rebecca's stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, the most important stuff is yet to come then.
No, right. I don't think that's true, but we'll share just a couple of minutes of something here. So let me put this up on the screen.
Okay.
View slideshow. All right. So just a note, and these are just two cool things that I thought. There really wasn't a ton of news this week, but I thought these two things were really interesting. This is former Mormon Judy Just has written a novel based on the life of Joseph Smith, founder of Mormonism. Rather than a critical expose, she's an ex-Mormon, had a faith crisis, discovered the factual history, the historical documentary history, and it didn't mesh with the correlated narrative. Surprise, surprise. So she ended up writing a book, Holy Joe, Prophet, Seer, and Revelator. It's instead an attempt to tell, I think, a balanced narrative using firsthand information and documentation by historical characters to tell the story of the prophet Joseph Smith. And it starts right at the beginning with the treasure digging and the occult. Like many, she explored Mormonism. She lost her faith, learning the actual history after learning correlated church narrative, shock, betrayal, all the things that we all, you know, experience on that path. She used her book as a way of processing her journey. And I think it's a great chance. I haven't read it yet, but I saw the news on it this week. It looks like a great chance for many folks to process their faith journey as well.
Bill, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You said her name is Judy Just. I'm seeing
her just Judy. Yeah, sorry.
Just Judy. Is that her real name or is it just sort of a no?
I don't know if it's like a pseudonymous thing. I don't know.
Like she's just Judy.
Yeah.
She could be related to Cody Judy.
No idea.
And her parents are named her Just?
Yeah, far as I know, she's just Judy.
Maybe it could happen.
So there's that book. It's out there. It's been out for a while, but she ended up doing like a rewrite of it. And this time it's getting some traction. So there's that. And then this was, I thought, a really cool story. Under the banner of Big Iron Productions, the creative minds behind Not Part of the Plan unite in their mission to uplift and empower queer youth, recognizing the need for improved treatment and support. Within the Utah community, the team is committed to amplifying voices of marginalized individuals and fostering greater inclusivity. This is a groundbreaking docuseries titled Not Part of the Plan. It's currently in development. They were talking about shopping the show, but it looks like it is going to get some traction and get picked up by somebody. Offering an intimate exploration of the lives of four queer Mormon teenagers, spearheaded by a team of acclaimed producers and directors, the project aims to shed light on the challenges, victories, and support systems experienced by LGBTQ youth within Utah's Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I actually think there would be quite a bunch of people watching this in and out of the church. It really looks like an interesting sort of way of kind of showing the lives of these kids. Executive producers Wilson Cruz, who some may recognize there on the left. I'll show a picture from something he's from that I've watched and know him. Amy Redford, Zan Parker, and Hadley Arnst are at the helm. They're the executive producers, not part of the plan, with directorial duties handled by Stephen Franson, who's actually a sitting bishop, active Mormon in the church. So executive producer Wilson Cruz, I know him from Star Trek Discovery. He's
well, that's why here, he's not at all familiar to me.
Yeah, you're just that original Star Trek, and that's it. There's no, no Scotty in this one. So the personal stories of these young, this is what Cruz said. He said, the personal stories of these young queer people telling us who they are will give us an opportunity to hopefully change minds and hearts while educating others so that they are more informed, more open, more caring, said Cruz, who highlights the urgency for this docuseries at a time when LGBTQIA issues are under attack. These types of shows, from my experience, save lives. The urgency is now. He plays a gay man on Star Trek. He's in a gay relationship with another one of the characters. And here's the director, Stephen Franson, a practicing Mormon and a bishop in the church. And he says this docuseries invites the audience into these kids' experience in the LDS community and let the audience learn a little bit about what they go through on a daily basis as a member of the Mormon community, he shared. The series invites people to see the truth about the lives of queer youth in religious communities. And I just want to say, I'm trying to remember what his name, a good friend of mine, but I just forgot his name. Kevin, he was a gay, not gay. He was a bishop in the LDS church, but he was a gay ally. And he gave a talk at a couple of like Mormon, post-Mormon sort of functions. And he got a lot of flack. This was back in 2012, 2013. And if you remember, Mitch Main at the time was a gay man who was serving in a bishopric. And it was this moment in time in Mormonism where for the very first time ever out loud, Mitch Main is serving in a bishopric as a gay man. There's a bishop who's supporting gay people as an ally. And you could sort of sense like, nah, it's not really allowed. We can't really do that. And they were sort of pushing anyway to do it, to be where they were. And they were, you know, supported by their ward in doing so to some extent. Here we have an active current bishop who is about to put forth a docuseries that represents LGBT kids in Utah in the LDS church. And this, we're at a point now where this is just sort of no big deal. This is sort of just normal. And so from that point of view, you know, in the last 15 years or so, the church has really moved a little bit. And I think you mentioned it earlier, progress is progress. And it's easy to pick on progress saying like, oh, you disadvantaged somebody in the past. Well, also we ought to appreciate the progress when it happens. And the church is, as we've covered in recent weeks and months, either forced or coming along willing, having to adjust to making more space for people that it used to never make space for at all. And I think that's a big deal. That was my last slide. Again, this is being shopped at the moment. Not sure exactly what network will pick it up, but wherever it is, I can tell you this much, I'll be watching it. Back to you guys.
Very good. Thank you, Bill Reel, for that report. Rebecca Biblioteca, do you have any comments at all about anything?
About anything. I do have a comment about speaking over you. So I have a perspective on that when you say, you know, the church is changing and all this. I did an episode recently where I was just so curious. That's how all my episodes start. I'm really curious. This is on Mormonish Podcast. And we found four same-sex married active LDS couples. And we wanted to see how they were treated. They were in different states. Some were in Utah, some were in California. And across the board, we realized that it is, you want to call it bishop roulette, but it's local leaders. These decisions of what couples are allowed to do and participate in are left up to, for the most part, local leaders. like the top, they're not weighing in. They're giving their talks or saying their things, but we found such a difference in treatment. We found one married same-sex couple that were taking the sacrament and had callings, and they did not appear, but they, you know, we learned that about them. We talked to another who had just gotten married and they were going to start in their new ward, and they had been very supported and included in their former ward as they got married. We found another couple who, when they announced they were going to get married, they were given the choice to resign or be excommunicated. These are all the same time frame. These are all within the last year. These are four same-sex married couples. Huge disparity in how they're treated. We found some where they can't officially hold a calling, but their leaders tried to find a way to include them. Let's let you participate here. Let's give you this little calling on the side. So to me, I feel like these local leaders are heroes and trying to move the needle, like you just talked about, Bill, with the one that's making the documentary. That's where it's happening, you know, and it's kind of like the Mountain Meadows Massacre, right? They wash their hands of it at the top. It's local leaders. In that case, they blame them. In this case, they are washing their hands, but they're leading these local leaders to make these decisions, and they're making a difference. And by doing that, these couples participate in the ward. They're loved by the ward. They're friends with everyone in the ward. You don't think the ward is going to rally and support these people if anything harmful happens when a bishop changes? That was the one downside we saw. When there's a change in leadership, there can be a complete change in how they're treated, to the point where one couple said, oh yeah, when it changed, they told us, okay, well, you have to come in, when they'd been fully accepted for the last several years. So it's a really interesting dynamic. And I think a documentary like this one is going to do a lot to just help people understand what's happening. And I will shout out to another documentary, A Long Way from Heaven. It's the documentary I talked about before, about 2 months ago, about the LGBTQ community at BYU and what's happened over the last 4 or 5 years with the change in the honor code and the lighting the why. That premiered in Lehi a month ago. They're also shopping that around for film festivals here in Utah. I would hope that here at the newscast, we can help people stay informed when these documentaries do pop up, because we'd love to have everybody come see them. They're really important.
Yeah. And I think those are great comments, Rebecca. I would suggest that the top leadership pushing their responsibilities mm-hmm. down to local leaders is not leadership on the general level. It strikes me as an abdication of leadership. Once again, these are not leaders in any meaningful sense of the word, at least not to my mind. At any rate, what a great show. What great stories. I'm glad I got back and the internet came back up. So thank you so much, everybody. Thank you for watching. Please hit like. Please hit subscribe. Please join us next week for another episode of the Mormon Newscast. Good night, everybody.